This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. With the official start of hurricane season just days away, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has released their predictions for 2014. They're expecting a near-normal or below-normal season in the Atlantic Hurricane Basin. Warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in Newport, John Cole, says El Nino conditions are expected to develop, which would reduce the number and intensity of storms.
We're not sure whether it's going to be a weak El Nino or a moderate El Nino. Some models project a moderate, where the water temperatures in the eastern Pacific warm in that area about a degree above normal, and some models are showing about a half a degree Celsius above normal. So it really depends on that as far as how much wind shear we're going to get across the Atlantic hurricane basin. And if we do get El Nino form like it is expected, then we should see a lower number of storms out there.
NOAA is predicting 8 to 13 named storms, of which 3 to 6 could become hurricanes, including 1 to 2 major hurricanes. Hurricanes and tropical storms are given names, which are selected by the World Meteorological Organization. The names of the first few storms will be Arthur, Bertha, Cristobal, and Dolly. While meteorologists are predicting a low-frequency year, it's vitally important to be prepared because the threat of a major hurricane is always possible.
In 2 years that point this out are 1992, where we had Hurricane Andrew. We only had 7 named storms that year. Hurricane Andrew was Category 5 that devastated South Florida and then went on to strike Louisiana as a Category 3. Also in 1993, that was a weak El Nino year as well. And we had a major hurricane on the Outer Banks, Hurricane Emily, which was a Category 3.
Whether it's storm surge models or hurricane warnings and watches, distributing information to the public is a top priority during hurricanes or tropical storms. Local elected officials, Weather Service offices, the media, and county emergency management offices all play an integral role in keeping the public safe during severe weather. As National Hurricane Preparedness Week is underway, emergency management offices across eastern North Carolina have already started getting ready before the start of hurricane season. Beaufort County Emergency Services Coordinator John Pack says the county is preparing by conducting training on the Emergency Operations Plan.
The plan has checklists for every man-made or natural disaster that we have experienced over the years, and each of our agencies through training here at the EOC has gone through their checklist and is checking off the items as being completed, or they're saying, okay, we've got 6 new people, we need to train them on their responsibilities at a shelter.
Familiarity with the emergency operations plan paid off when an EF3 tornado touched down in Beaufort County on April 25th. The tornado lifted and touched down again on the opposite side of the Pamlico River as an EF2. Hundreds of homes were damaged and 16 people were injured. Pack says this severe weather event gave emergency service providers a chance to improve their planning and coordination with different agencies.
It involves everyone from the Department of Social Services to the Health Department, of course, the first responder agencies, law enforcement. So we all had the opportunity to get ourselves refreshed through the tornadic event that occurred.
Pack says the April 25th tornado also revealed some areas where the different agencies could improve their services. Beaufort County utilizes an emergency notification system called HyperReach, which calls a person's cell phone or landline and provides emergency alerts to residents who may be affected by severe weather.
A lot of home phones got calls 10 minutes before the tornadoes came tearing down through their home that a tornado was approaching and please take shelter. Several people that had registered with the cell phones got those. But what we learned was not everybody had taken our message seriously about registering their cell phones.
Pack says there's a greater chance a person will receive the important emergency information if it's delivered to a cell phone rather than a landline. In the 2 months since the tornadoes, Beaufort County Emergency Services has focused on making residents aware of the HyperReach service, and they have more than doubled the number of participation with people receiving alerts on their cell phones. Pack says now they have the capability to notify 40,000 Beaufort County residents within 10 minutes. He says this type of connection will prove effective before, during, and after a hurricane event.
You can get alerted to the status of hurricanes, to an evacuation notice to something as simple as your water's going to be off for one day in your home.
In preparation of hurricane season, PAC says they're encouraging people to get ready by making a disaster supplies kit and planning their evacuation route.
If you're in a floodplain in Beaufort County, you're going to get notified to evacuate. And we do not encourage anyone to stay inside our floodplains because, as we learned during Hurricane Irene, everything in our 100-year and 500-year floodplain in the eastern part of the county got water in it. And just because you elevate your house does not mean it is safe to stay in that house. When you're completely surrounded by water, you have no escape.
Keeping residents safe is the top priority for emergency services offices in eastern North Carolina. Craven County Director of Emergency Services Stanley Kite is encouraging citizens to stay informed via their cell phones.
We also have, in today's world, a lot of apps that are out there for providers providing services for free, including the National Weather Service, the Red Cross apps. North Carolina has a Ready NC site that has a lot of information to help you be prepared and also help you stay informed and get alerts.
Kite is also encouraging people to sign up for their mass notification system, Code Red, which sends out a text or voice message to Craven County residents who may be in harm's way.
We would do more specific information, evacuation information, shelter information, and in some cases, if we were highly impacted, we'd be trying to send probably some recovery or specific instructions to specific communities that were hardest hit through that system.
Craven County Emergency Management has also been conducting simulations and exercises, as well as reviewing their action plans ahead of the storm season. Kite says it's important for residents to stay safe during a hurricane or tropical storm because when sustained winds reach 50 miles per hour, 911 response stops.
You can't kill the fire and rescue community and law enforcement community trying to respond and when conditions are threatening them. So anyone that has a question on that, I'd be glad one day to let them have a courtesy ride when we're having our March winds of about 35 across one of those bridges in one of those boxed hamlets, and I think you'd understand why.
It's Hurricane Preparedness Week, and even with a below normal season predicted, it's important to prepare well ahead of any approaching tropical weather. National Weather Service Warning Coordination Meteorologist John Cole encourages folks to prepare a disaster supplies kit.
You need non-perishable supplies, of course, and medicines are essential to last for a duration of at least 3 to 5 days. So water would be in there. That would be some of the main things.
Some other items to include in your disaster supplies kit: a flashlight, extra batteries, cell phone charger, first aid kit, and a battery-powered or hand crank radio. For more hurricane preparedness tips, visit our website, publicradioeast.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. If you're a gardener, you understand that everything is seasonal. Right now, well, garlic is just starting to ripen. But peas, they're almost finished. Plums are ready for harvest. But apples, they're small and hard and sour for quite a while longer. The spring flowers, well, they're gone. But the summer crepe myrtles, they haven't even started to open, so we can look forward to them. So along with these seasonal changes in the garden come, well, larger seasons. And for us, it's the beginning of hurricane season. And that has an even different meaning for people with gardens. So what do we have to think about with regard to our yards in hurricanes? Right on the coast, we can have winds filled with salt that can burn many plants. But if the salty winds come first and then the torrential rains, well, the rains rinse the salt away and it doesn't matter. But then you might have damage from flooding. Flooding from rising water might be salt water, which can cause its own problems. But if it's just flooding from torrential rains, you simply may have plants that drown. The best way to avoid damage from too much rain is to try and grade your yard and shape your beds so that excess water runs off. That's if you don't have well-drained soil that can take on the water on its own. You can also adjust your yard to deal with heavy rains by putting in rain gardens. Shape your yard so that the water drains into depressions in the soil that are planted with plants that enjoy wet feet. Let the rain accumulate there during the really heavy downpours and then slowly percolate into the soil afterwards. If you don't get rain after the salt spray, well, if you have access to clean water, just hose off the leaves of the more sensitive plants and hope that the long-term burn will be minimal. The biggest issue with hurricanes here on the coast is, of course, wind. And there's just some plants that can't take it, and it's best to avoid them. Probably two of the plants most damaged by hurricane winds are Bradford pears and pecans. Now, if you want a pecan or a pecan tree, whichever you wish to call it, just keep it far away from the house, buildings, and cars that could be damaged when the limbs break off. I'm certainly not going to tell people in the South not to grow pecan trees. Bradford pears are another story. If you're on the coast where there's hurricanes, there are other options, and you should just avoid them. They have brittle wood and weak joints where the branches join to the trunk in one another, and they tend to split in half quite readily. For a list of plants that are good in hurricane areas and those to avoid, go to the Carteret County Cooperative Extension website at carteret.ces.ncsu.edu. Click on Lawn and Garden, and then scroll down to the documents that deal with hurricane plants. Use those to help shape your yard now that you're thinking about hurricane season here in North Carolina. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
Research by a team of coastal scientists at the University of Chapel Hill's Institute of Marine Sciences is gaining national attention. The study looked at the rate at which oyster reefs grow and if they'll be able to keep pace with rising sea levels. After 10 years of study in coastal North Carolina, the results show that oyster reefs grow much faster than previously expected and can also be an effective way of slowing erosion. This week, I spoke with Dr. Antonio Rodriguez, associate professor at Institute of Marine Sciences, about the research project and how the creation of an oyster reef could be more effective than a bulkhead for protecting the shoreline.
If constructed correctly, oyster reefs could really outlive bulkheads because they can grow upward, and they grow upward really quickly.
And as a part of your research, your team of scientists have been growing an oyster reef in Back Sound in Carteret County. What have you been able to learn from constructing that reef?
So what we learned is that oyster reefs grow very rapidly, and previous work showed that they grow much less than an inch a year. And what we found is that they have the potential to grow 4.5 inches a year.
So what does that mean as far as the potential for oyster reefs being constructed in coastal North Carolina?
Well, what that means is, well, first of all, we're in the lower parts of estuaries. So oyster reefs here like to grow in the intertidal areas. And if they become subtidal, they won't grow anymore. And so if you think about sea level rise in the future, it's important to understand and to examine whether these reefs can keep up with sea level rise. Because if they can't, they'll likely cease to exist.
Your study was published in Nature Climate Change, also in newspapers and magazines and other publications across the country. Now, as your research receives national attention, what do you hope people will take away?
I hope what they'll take away is that if we start to construct reefs the way we did in this paper, they'll protect the shoreline from erosion or help with erosion. But at the same time, they'll provide important fish habitat. They also clean the water. That's really important, and no bulkhead can provide all of those services. So maybe we'll move towards more natural alternatives to shoreline stabilization.
Do you also hope that people reading the results of your study will consider building an oyster reef as opposed to constructing a bulkhead for shoreline erosion protection?
Definitely. That's our hope.
Now, when it comes to actually constructing an oyster reef, how much cheaper is it than a traditional seawall or bulkhead?
Well, I don't know how much it costs to construct a bulkhead, but what we did is just spread out a thin layer of oyster shell and in the intertidal areas. And by thin layer, what I mean is it was only 6 inches high. And they grew to be about 3 feet high in just about 10 years.
As you were saying before, oyster reefs, of course, are beneficial for the environment. It's not as damaging as a seawall or bulkhead. And oysters, which are filter feeders, are good for the aquatic ecosystem because they help improve water quality. But are there any drawbacks or things that people should consider when choosing to construct an oyster reef?
The drawback is the oysters can die, so they can catch a disease or be preyed upon, and maybe the hydrodynamics in the areas change, so there's less flow. And so I guess that would be a big drawback if you invest in building this reef, and then at some point in the future it dies from other reasons other than sea level rise. A bulkhead can't die.
Now, as far as people considering, constructing their own oyster reef, what are some things that they should keep in mind?
Well, they should keep in mind where they are in the estuary when they're constructing it. So if they're in the higher salinity parts of estuaries, the lower part of the estuary, that's where oyster reefs do really well, but they have to be planted intertidally. You don't want to create a subtidal reef so that it's underwater all the time at that setting. So that's the most important take-home message, I think.
Dr. Antonio Rodriguez is an associate professor at the Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
This week, the life and legacy of the author and conservationist Rachel Carson was honored with a Google Doodle as Wednesday marked what would have been her 107th birthday. Carson is known for her work as a nature advocate, the founder of the contemporary environmental movement, and for her book, Silent Spring, published more than 50 years ago. Today on the Downeast Journal, Stephen O'Connell remembers her contributions to environmental science and her ties to Eastern North Carolina.
While researching information for a public interest book, Carson traveled from Maine all the way down the coast, making a stop in Beaufort, North Carolina. Professor of Marine Ecology at the Duke Marine Lab, Dr. William Kirby Smith.
As I understand it, she used one of our boats and met with some of the staff here at the island, and then spent several days at low tide making notes and making observations, which she later incorporated into her book.
The Downeast region is home to the Rachel Carson Reserve, which was dedicated in 1985 to honor her work. The almost 2-mile island boasts a diverse ecosystem including salt marshes, sand dunes, shrub thicket, and maritime forests. Managed by the Division of Coastal Management to preserve natural resources and threatened coastal habitat, the 2,600-acre sanctuary is home to feral horses and 200 bird species, 23 of which are considered rare or decreasing in number. Carson is most well known for her book, Silent Spring, which challenges common beliefs about the use of pesticides. Many people credit her work with the budding of environmentalism. William Souder has written about the life and legacy of Rachel Carson. He says her writing elucidated the fact that man was affecting his environment, an idea that steered away from the more passive ideas of conservationism.
With Rachel Carson and Silent Spring, we get a fairly significant change in that outlook, and that really begins what we now call the modern environmental movement. And in environmentalism, the perspective is slightly different. It's a little more urgent. It's a little more pessimistic.
Carson spent 4 years researching the data being collected by scientists on the effects of pesticides such as DDT. She died shortly after the book was published. Souder says her ideas caused changes that resounded throughout the decade.
In the wake of Silent Spring, throughout the balance of that decade, the environmental movement really did blossom. There was important legislation, the Clean Air Act, which actually passed in 1963 while Carson was still alive, and then later the Clean Water Act. And then in 1970, probably the most significant, fairly direct result of Silent Spring was that the Nixon administration created the Environmental Protection Agency. And one of the first orders of business for the EPA was to examine DDT and a bunch of other closely related pesticides, and the agency ended up banning the domestic use of those pesticides in 1972 and going forward.
Although the use of pesticides were never banned around the world and are still in use today in the United States, there is research into the use of pesticides going on around the country.
There are a lot of herbicides still used in American agriculture, as well as other fungicides and insecticides. But certainly one of the developments that has happened recently is that we have learned how to modify food crops so that they are resistant to certain pesticides. And what that encourages, of course, is the continued use of pesticides on crops because it's economically sensible to do so.
If you are interested in reading more about Rachel Carson, William Souter recently published a book called On a Farther Shore, The Life and Legacy of Rachel Carson. Stephen O'Connell, Public Radio East.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our Public Radio East members in partnership with Warden Smith PA, a full-service law firm with specialized practice groups in real estate, agribusiness, elder law, and more. Warden Smith, dedicated to the practice of law. Information online at wardensmith.com. Coming up next weekend, it's the 15th annual Okrafolk Music and Storytelling Festival. Public Radio East is a media sponsor of the event, which takes place June 6th, 7th, and 8th on Ocracoke Island. The free 3-day celebration showcases musicians, artisans, and the culture and heritage of the island and eastern North Carolina. Public Radio East's Mac McKee speaks with General Director of the Okrafolk Festival, David Tweedy.
I understand that you're not just a performer at the festival, you're also one of its original founders.
Yes, started in 2000 by my Molasses Creek bandmate Gary Mitchell, and I assisted a little bit that year, but the following year we put it together with a arts and crafts festival that had been going on the island, and so we combined the music and the regional artisans and put it all together, and it kind of took off from there and has been going ever since.
Now, the Okrafolk Festival, as you said, has been going on for 15 years. When you first started from those humble beginnings, how much has the Okrafolk Festival been growing? You know, it's been listed as one of the 15 top festivals in the world.
Yeah, there was an article that came out in Coastal Living magazine of island festivals, and we got ranked in that. And in fact, this year, the edition of our state magazine that just came out features the Okrafolk Festival as well in talking about summer festivals, so we were pretty excited about that. But it grew from a one-day event on the grounds of the historic Berkeley Manor to what it is today, which kind of takes over the village a little bit for the weekend.
What are some of the featured events that are part of this year's Okrafolk celebration?
Off on Friday with Donald Davis's storytelling group telling some stories at Deepwater Theater, and we have a fish fry, and then we have a fundraising auction at the Berkeley Manor. And then on Saturday, we've got a full day of activities. We've got performances by musicians and storytellers, some of them from the region and others of them that come from farther afield. And that happens all during the day. And then in the evening, there's a traditional Ocracoke square dance.
I understand the festivities will last through the weekend and into Sunday, with some of the events happening before the local churches have their services.
Yes, things kick off with yoga at Deepwater Theater, and then there's a gospel sing that happens at the stage before local churches have their services, and then more music and storytelling from 12 to 4 on Sunday afternoon, and it's a wonderful event. We have about, I would guess, around 3,000 people come to the island before the weekend.
The festival, of course, is not just about music, David, but it's also about storytelling. How did the storytelling part of the festival come into being?
Well, a big part of that is that one of our friends and a great community participant, Donald Davis, is an internationally renowned storyteller. He's originally from the mountains of North Carolina, and he and his wife, Merle, are very involved in the community. And he spends a lot of the time during the year traveling all throughout the United States and abroad, telling stories of growing up in the mountains of North Carolina. But they also make Ocracoke Island their home, and both he and Merle, they put together some storytelling workshop weeks, and some of those participants are also in the village. And so they also tell some stories in some of the events leading up to the festival. So that's one of the main reasons why we had storytelling. But we always felt like storytelling in the eastern part of North Carolina was an important part of the culture. And we have Rodney Kemp, who comes over from the Morehead City, the Down East area, and tells fish house lies and things like that. And usually we have a couple other folks who participate in that as well.
David, what are the dates and times for the Okrafolk Festival once again?
So this year it is June 6th through 8th. It's the first full weekend in June every year.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a great pleasure, and hope to see folks here on the island for the big event.